It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Today we have not one, but four outstanding guests to talk about their knowledge and firsthand experience as we take a look at the history of sports broadcasting at the University of Kentucky. You'll hear some of the most inside stories involving the careers of play-by-play announcers Claude Sullivan, Kaywood Ledford, Ralph Hacker, and Tom Leach. Ralph and Tom were part of our panel discussion recently, as were longtime UK broadcaster Dick Gabriel and Alan Sullivan, Claude's son, who did extensive research to go along with his own personal memories and wrote a book about his father's life and career. The event was one of a series of programs presented by the Lexington History Museum and took place at the East Side branch of the Lexington Public Library. We hope you enjoy this look at the history of UK sports broadcasting.
Alan, I want to get to Claude's career here in just a moment as we begin, but let me first start things off by just asking each of you to respond and tell us about your first memory of UK sports broadcasting, when you first clicked with you that not only that it might be something you'd be interested in, but just as a fan, that you made a connection with a broadcaster, whether it was Kaywood or Ralph or whoever it happened to be. And, Alan, you would have probably a little different perspective than the other three, but tell us about yours.
I was kind of born into it and drug into it. Yeah. But I enjoyed it. I think the first memories are Memorial Coliseum in the 50s. And my brother was 3 years older, so he got to go to the games before I did with my mother, who was one of the greatest sports people I've ever known as far as knowing her stuff. And we were always interested because it was always around us. So when I first got the opportunity to work with Dad on the broadcast, I was 12 years old, and my brother and I were both directors in Sullivan Enterprises, which was the company he formed to eventually he saw being the UK Sports Network. So the WVLK became part of the Standard Oil Sports Network and not the originating station. But we got a lot of access to Claude, and we went on a road trip with the Cincinnati Reds, being with Pete Rose and Frank Robinson and all those guys. And that was, you know, we learned at an early age that when they said, Dad asked the Reds, could we go on this trip? And they said, well, we usually don't allow that, but we've seen your boys with you down on the field with your interviews, and they're very polite, so we'd say, let's give it a try. So we heard that, and we thought, why would we not be nice when we get this opportunity? I can't understand why they'd think any different. So, and then one of my big jobs was, there was three of us at the press table, my brother flanking Dad. And so when the game was over, I got to go with the state police back to the locker room and tell Adolph that we were ready for his interview, which I think was just Dad's way of letting me have something to do and have something important. So, but I kept all the stats, and to this day, I mentally, as Tom will know, as you, and Ralph, as you go through a game, now you're listening, you keep the stats kind of in your head because you're used to it. Now I think maybe it's available on computers and you can look it up very quickly, but back then you had to write it down and keep it in your head. We had a lot of access, like going to Memorial Coliseum, seeing some of the practices. And Adolph wasn't real big on that. He didn't let a lot of people come to the practices. And back in the early days, Claude traveled with the team and by train in the 40s to Wisconsin, to New York. Joe Hall told me that he was on the train with Dad going to New York to Madison Square Garden for the NIT in 49. He said the Fabulous Five all went by plane. He said, but your dad and I were on the train with all the other players. And then finally, I guess another thing, my brother went to the Texas Western game and did the engineering. And I asked him recently, I said, David, do you recall, how come I didn't go to that game? And he goes, I don't know. I guess you were in school or something. But he set up all the engineering work and was by himself. Dad was in Tampa doing the Reds spring training, had to fly up for the game, had to fly back in between the Duke game and Texas Western, do another baseball game. He's one of the few announcers that's ever been able to manage Major League Baseball with a major college sports program. Dick Enberg is the only other one I know that really was able to pull that off with the Padres and forget his college team. So that was, I guess, my access, was just being in the family at the right place at the right time, and 12 years old, being a director in a company was kind of a big deal. I didn't understand what it really meant, but we had meetings.
You're giving a whole new meaning to the term junior executive.
That's right. And my brother went on to have a career at ESPN and at University of Louisville because Ralph was doing the games here, and Jim Host hired David to produce a lot of the television broadcasts. And then he got a call from his agent saying, I got a job for you in your backyard. Would you take U of L? And he goes, begrudgingly, but... You know, he did, and he Howard Schnellenberger and Denny Crum were the coaches, and he had a very good run with them for 8 years. So.
Ralph, what about you? Your connections growing up there in Madison County, you were probably a Wildcat fan right away, I assume.
We lived so far back in eastern Madison County, we didn't get Saturday's games till late Tuesday afternoon. But when we got them, Claude was doing them. I can tell you that. So I grew up listening to Claude Sullivan. No question. That's where my greatest influence came from, wanting to be a sports announcer, was from Claude Sullivan. I always wanted to be a baseball player, but somewhere along the way I realized I wasn't nearly good enough to play baseball, that I better try to figure out if I can do something else. So by listening to Claude and listening to Jack Buck and to listening a little bit to Kaywood, but not a lot, Kaywood really wasn't doing the games then. He was doing them on WLEX radio here, which is now 1300. I don't know what it's called this week, but 1300 is what it was. Kaywood, we knew Kaywood through being a television sports announcer. He had come from somewhere in the mountains, we weren't sure, and he was the sports anchor on Channel 18. That's what he was. So that's how we knew who Kaywood. My other influences were a guy named O.C. Halliard, who had worked with Claude at WVLK, and he came over to run the radio station at Richmond, and he broadcast the Eastern Kentucky ball games over there. So I grew up going to the Eastern Kentucky ball games because we couldn't afford to come to the University of Kentucky and watch the University of Kentucky play. And the same thing when I was in high school is that the real heroes of mine, even though I knew the University of Kentucky through listening to them, it was Eastern Kentucky State College with the people that they had right then and Coach Paul McBrayer. Unlike many of these guys, Alan probably got into it like he did. I've had a different arrangement than most of these guys, totally a different arrangement. I think Alan would agree with that. I took Claude Sullivan's advice, and you'll find what I said about it in the book. Claude told me to build a wheel, not to rely on one spoke, to try to do different things in my life that would eventually put a spoke here, a spoke there, a spoke there, and in that, I would build a wheel. And if one of those spokes broke while it was being repaired, I could go ahead and continue working and continue to make a living. So one of the many things that I did, I had a different relationship with Coach Rupp and Coach Ray and Coach Bradshaw and all of the football coaches, everybody right up to the time I left through Tubby Smith doing it, is that I really had their contract to pay them to do their radio shows. And they made more off of the radio shows than they made from the University of Kentucky. Ralph Gabbard, who was my childhood buddy, ran Channel 27. Ralph had the contract for television, for them doing the television shows. And so together, the coaches worked for us. And then this went right on up, you know, through Patino. And an interesting thing about Patino that people don't know, and he's gone now, is that when he lost to Duke, and this wasn't the first time he pulled this. I want you to know that. But my answer was always the same. Brooks Dunning came out and says, Coach says he's not going to do the coach's show tonight, post-game show. I walked back there. He was just raising all sorts of cane and using profanity about that long and said he didn't want to talk to effing Kaywood Ledford, you know, after you just lost the national championship. He said, what the hell are you doing here? I said, if you don't want to get paid, don't come out. Which was my standard answer to it. He beat me to the table. Because one time early on in his career, he had not come out, and I made damn sure he didn't get a check, you know, for doing that. And Alan knows this. And Alan was on our management team there. So my relationship with those guys was much different. And in having the relationship with the coaches that I had, it really, by some respect, I think, Tom, you and Dick would both agree, gave me access to the players mm-hmm. that you guys never ended up getting. Mm-hmm. Is they trusted me, the coaches did, and they would trust me to talk to the players, and if there was something that should not be reported, I'd use my discretion about not reporting it, you know, on the thing. So my relationship through the entire 34 years that I was there was much, much different than what these guys had. Mm-hmm. While I was reporting on the games, in some respects, I owned them.
Tom, that is a little different arrangement,
yes.
I guess.
Yes, it is.
But tell us about your first contact, Tom.
My first memory, it's one of two things. The first time I can remember listening to a Kentucky broadcast, I would have been 10 years old because this was 1971. There's one of those old box radios with a big round dial in the middle. And it was on my parents' bed, and I remember sitting there listening to the start of the football season in 1971. Kentucky, Clemson, at Clemson, kicked off. Doug Coder fielded the kickoff and ran it back for a touchdown. Mm-hmm. The last time, maybe the only time, that the opening kickoff of a season was taken back for a touchdown, mm-hmm. and I remember that moment for whatever reason. The other thing is that it's Claude's call of the famous Vernon Hatton shot, because somewhere around that same time, I got that album. I still have a copy of it, actually, of the great moments in Kentucky basketball that Kaywood narrated, but it was a history of Kentucky basketball, and that was one of the clips on that album. So those are two early memories of UK sports for me. Didn't have any particular connection to the university or anybody in my family had ever done sports broadcasting, so I just fell in love with it, and kind of much like Ralph, I realized I wasn't going to make it to the Reds, and so if I wanted to stay in sports, you'd probably take the coaching path or the media path, and I've always told student groups that I've talked to, when I was growing up, ESPN started in my senior year of high school, so you listened to more sports than you watched, unlike today, and so I was captivated by the guys doing radio, listening to Kaywood primarily as far as a play-by-play influence. So he, you know, a lot of, I'm sure there's even things unconsciously I do related to listening to him and Ralph on the broadcast. The guy who probably had the greatest influence on the way I, you know, do the job and professionalism and things even to setting up a spotting board and all those things is the guy to my right. I worked for him for 16 years, and Jim Host also after he hired me to be on the network. So those were the great influences for me. I'll tell you one funny story too with told the Coach Pitino story. This is another one that Ralph told me about. This was before Mike Pratt and I were doing the games. Kentucky traveled on the day of the game in those days to road games. So they were going to Georgia, and they were flying on an old kind of beat-up plane, and the plane, they're on the plane.
Was it
Music City? So they're on the the plane out at Bluegrass, and Jeff Shepard says, "Coach, the engine's on fire." And it was. So they get everybody off the plane. They start calling boosters that have private planes. Ralph probably helped orchestrate a lot of that. And to get, you know, one private plane takes the starters, and the next one takes the rest of the players, and then maybe another one takes the coaches, and they get all these people lined up, and Coach Pitino's going to be on the last one, and he turns to Ralph and Kyle Macy and the producer-engineer Mike Dodson, "You boys are on your own." At about 2 o'clock for an 8 o'clock game, they race back over to Bluegrass, get a commercial flight to Atlanta, rent a car, drive through Atlanta traffic, get to Athens, and get on the air about 30 seconds before tip-off, if my memory is correct.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you later about relationships with coaches. I was thinking in terms of interviews and things like that, but it goes a lot further than that. Dick, what about you?
Talk into this thing, is that right?
I think so, yeah.
I marvel at the dumb luck that I've had in my career. I mean, Alan had the genetic lottery ticket, but I mean, I was sitting at a game. I was covering a game for the Colonel, for the student newspaper at UK, and in the end zone. And the campus station usually set up, I mean, right here. The general manager was here, and then the announcer was Rafis. And honestly, I mean, I'm not the greatest, but the guy wasn't very good. And eventually he quit because they wouldn't put him on the air. They just taped the broadcast, and I went over it with him, and he got ticked off, and he left. So one day I show up, and Don Wheeler, is the, we all know Don, like great, was just sitting there like this, and I said, not doing the game tonight? No, I lost my announcer. I said, oh, and I'm looking at the game, and I like this, I said, you know, I've always wanted to try something like that. And he goes, call me. All right. And I did, and I auditioned, and the next thing I know, I'm doing play-by-play at WBKY. Mm-hmm. I did it for 3 years, home games for football and basketball. My partner was a bartender who was a non-traditional student who had gone back to school, and he tended bar where Don threw a few back at Charlie Brown's, and they talked sports all the time. And Don was like, you know, you ought to be a sportscaster because this guy can talk. And so here's his two most unlikely guys, and they threw us together, and, you know, he didn't hit it off at first, and then he ended up being like the big brother I never had. Our chemistry was so good. And, in fact, Don liked it so much that I think the second year he started looking for high school games for us to do close to home when Kentucky was on the road, because back then games were sent back on phone lines, and the farther – it was like a long-distance call. Farther away you were, the more expensive. So we would do some local games. We'd go to Somerset and stuff like that just to get experience. And so it was wonderful. And so, but still I'm thinking I'm going to be a newspaper man when I get out of school. Now, in the meantime, I'm around – the UK broadcasters, there's Kaywood Ledford and Ralph Hacker, and Kaywood's the guy I grew up with in Louisville. I was a baseball nut. I mean, I'm just now giving up hope that the Cardinals are going to call me to play third base. So I listened to Kay more late 60s. I've heard Claude Sullivan on recordings, but I did not grow up listening to him. I listened to Kaywood and then eventually Ralph as well. But there they are, and treated me like a pro. I always appreciated that when I was in college. They didn't treat me like a kid, and I've always tried to do that to younger people. But I remember you guys used to do the freshman games. It was Ralph and a gentleman named Rick Shaw and John Henderson, who I think worked at the station at the time. All three of them were tall with blonde hair and big, beautiful voices. And I'm like, well, I'll never crack that fraternity. You know, but I could hear them because the crowd wouldn't do it. Man, were they good. I mean, their broadcast was almost as good as Ralph and Kaywood. So I thought, you know, how fortunate am I? Well, I get out of school, had some newspaper offers, but I'm passing through Lexington again. Couldn't have been luckier. Heard a rumor that VLK was going to open up a job for a full-time sports director. It had been part-time up till then. Threw a resume in there. My best friend's dad was Rupp's lawyer, was the station's lawyer. He called him up because, you know, he's a nice boy. Give him an interview. Next thing I know, I'm working for Ralph. And because of that, again, right place, right time, in 1979, Kentucky was playing football at Florida and basketball at the very first tip-off classic in Springfield. It was a rematch of UK-Duke. And so I'm thinking, well, Ralph will do one and Cable will do the other, and I'll be ready to help in the studio or whatever. And they both said, no, we're going to Florida. We're not giving up on the football team. That would just really look bad because they were struggling. You're doing basketball. I'm like, mwah. So I think I'm one of, was it four people ever to fill in for Kaywood? You did it.
Yeah, and Don Estep from, yeah, up in Corbin, and Joel Utley,
yeah,
from down in Bowling Green. Yeah. If you don't count Van Vance subbing for it.
Yeah.
But those are the guys. We're the That's guys it. That sub for
it. Yeah. And Kaywood got caught in a snowstorm once, and somebody had to fill. I mean, it's right place, right time. And it was me and Jock Sutherland, who ended up being UK's nemesis for 19 years. But that's a different story. But anyhow, yeah, I've got that tape somewhere. But I also did, like I said, 3 years I did an NCAA championship in 78. I counted it up. I think four people listened, because they're all listening to Ralph and Kaywood. The board operator, station manager, station engineer, my mom. That's it. But it was a tremendous experience, and working for Ralph started the first call-in show. And at first I was hesitant because I said, you know, I was kind of a loose cannon a little bit. And I know he had a business arrangement with the university, and I said, look, I don't want to get you guys in trouble with something I might say. And he said something to me that I've repeated many, many times, especially to people who like to say, well, they tell you what to say on that call-in show. UK tells you what to say to the station. Never. No one has ever told me what to say, they leave it up to us, don't they? And all he said to me was, just remember, you have to maintain a professional relationship with these people. That's it. That's all he ever said to me. Now, he disagreed with some of the things I said on the air, but that's good. That's why I'm there. So I've always carried that, and I've maintained that business relationship. So I leave for a couple of years. I go to work for Jim Host. I'm down in Dallas. I'm a behind-the-scenes guy. Came back to work at WKYT running the sports department. And as far as I know, I'm the only guy who ever worked full-time for Ralph Hacker, Ralph Gabbert, and Jim Host. You talk about, again, lucky and learned so much. And again, right place, right time. UK decided we want to do more of the Olympic sports on TV. They handed me a list. They said, here's all the play-by-play things we're going to do. You need to assign them. Well, all my guys are fighting over the women's basketball and this and that. I said, well, I'm doing baseball, and I'm going to do volleyball because I love volleyball. So that's how I end up being a TV play-by-play guy, doing that. And you know, the difference between TV and radio and all that stuff, that's a great discussion to have some other time. I will say this, though, that learning how to do TV play-by-play was really interesting. But one thing that I don't know that you mentioned it or even knew, that Ralph was a CBS TV football announcer for 2 years. And I still believe that was your best work. I really believe that, and here's why. And I learned this doing NCAA radio. It's so great when you are doing a national broadcast and you don't have to do what we've all done, carry the gear, set it up, chase down interview. I mean, all of it. We love it. But when all you have to do is sit down and do the game, it is so emancipating. And I remember being in the station one day, and I used to pride myself on knowing who all these announcers were, and I'm walking by a monitor, and I hear this voice, and I'm like, I don't know that NFL announcer. And the more I listen, I'm like, that's Ralph. And I get out, I said, what? And he goes, yeah, you know, the blah, blah, blah. He told me how he ended up, you know, getting a couple years' worth out of it. And what I realized was when you're at that level, you've got producer, director, camera, researchers, associate producers, everybody who does that is the very best at their job. Their job is to work for you. And I learned that as a young producer. What you need to do is make it comfortable for your announcer so he doesn't have to worry about anything but doing the game. So when Ralph didn't have to worry about affiliates and affidavits and getting gear set up and this and that, all he had to do was the game. And was tremendous. And, you know, why it didn't go on from there, that's a different story. But that needs to be on his resume.
We'll add that in there, yeah. Well, as you can see, a variety of stories to make that first connection, but we're glad you all did. Alan, wanted to come back to you. You have – it's been just a tremendous project to assemble the material that resulted in the book, Voice of the Wildcats. Claude Sullivan, The Rise of Modern Sportscasting, tells the story of Claude's career. And tell us a little bit first about what you remember as a child that made Claude Sullivan the person that he was. In other words, someone who was capable of succeeding at the highest level, not necessarily what made him a great broadcaster, but what the qualities that he had that led him to success.
Well, preparation was his hallmark. I think Ralph will tell you that, and Jim Host, that he prepared for the games to the degree that nobody had another fact except for Claude. Ralph always says what was your description of that?
I said, if we all sat there and we read this weather forecast and we got down and said it's 39 degrees and the wind is out of the southwest at 7 miles an hour, and we're through, Claude would say, the blonde-headed lady's hair is blowing. Or something like that. He'd have one more fact than the rest of us.
And he would prepare, but he also mentored a lot of other announcers, and he loved doing it, a lot of WBKY announcers. And what he would do he would always spend time with anybody at the ball game, would come up to me and say, you know, I'm confused, Claude, but it shows that this guy, number 33, is not in the game or not in the program. And he'd always know. They'd come up to him sometimes instead of the sports information director for the other team because they know he'd researched it, learned every name, how you spell it, how you pronounce it, where they came from. And he sat Jim Host down once in a motel room on the road and said, come in and I'll show you my system, the Sullivan system. So he sat him down, he compared the fact books, the programs, and just said you start looking for commonalities and where you can draw statistical comparisons. And then he said there's another way that you can do that. And he said, Jim said, well, Claude, how do you come up with all these ad libs just out of nowhere? And he goes, I write them down in advance. They're not ad libs. So I get the statistics together, and then when I've compared them all, I start saying, well, you know, here's a comparison between Kentucky and Tennessee, and I can develop some ad libs to lead into this and to develop this. And he had it all planned out. He would study horse racing the same way. The night before, he'd have the programs, study the jockeys' names, the silks, because you couldn't always see the horse number if it was bad weather, but you had to know the jockey's silks, and you had 2 minutes to put all that together with these crazy horse names that you had to learn. And he would practice, you know, so-and-so's in the lead, followed by in his office, so he was comfortable with making those quick transitions. There were a lot of different things he did. One of the things was that He was always open, as I said, to comments from other people, but he would just stay after and talk to people. I'd be out with him, and somebody would stop him in the grocery store and talk to him for 10, 15 minutes, and I said, is that a friend of yours from the radio station? He goes, no, I've never met the guy. He just felt like he knew me, and I had a good time talking to him. He was from Somerset, and he'd tell me all about the guy. He had a great tenure with Kentucky that was, Dick was talking about the lottery ticket. His lottery ticket was he happened to start when Bear Bryant started, and Adolph Rupp was getting to his prime, to where from 1947 to 67, they had announced 4 NCAA championship games, the most anybody else had the opportunity to do. Plus he did Kansas and North Carolina in 57 just because he had the space signed up, and he knew that he thought Kentucky was going to be there, but they got beat in the semifinals and weren't there. So he did 5, counting the Will Chamberlain Kansas versus North Carolina triple overtime game. And but he also had the only football championship game of Kentucky, national championship in 1950 when we beat Oklahoma. There was no specific national championship, but they're still listed as the national champion because they beat undefeated Oklahoma, Bud Wilkinson's team that had gone, 30-some-odd games in a row without a loss, and that was a big deal when Kentucky beat them. But he had access to the coaches in a different way. Babe Parilli, I interviewed him for the book, and I said, Babe, I saw in here where Dad was a letter from Bear Bryant inviting him to Millersburg to the training camp. And I said, why would he invite the media to the training camp? And Babe said, He didn't invite the media to the training camp. He invited your dad because he knew your dad would only take out of there what he's supposed to take out of there, and what stayed in Millersburg stayed in Millersburg. And there was only one other person on the letter, and it was somebody from the newspaper. So he said he invited 2 people to that camp that he knew that he could trust. And one example, also, there weren't the media rooms that they have today. Back then, do you know where Bear Bryant did his coach's interview? At his house. So after a rare home loss, Mom said, Dad came up to me and said, Alice, he goes, I know Bear needs some support because this was a tough loss for him. He wasn't expected it. Everybody's on him, and he's on himself about it. And nobody's going to go out to his house because they're afraid to. So why don't we go out there and try to give him our support? So they went out there, and Bear answered the door, and his wife was there, and they came in. They invited him to sit down and talk, and he actually didn't talk about the game. They just talked for a while. And so at the end of the evening, Bear led Dad to the door, and he goes, you know, Claude, I really appreciate you coming out tonight. I guess those other son of a bitches were too scared to. And another opportunity Bear gave Dad was, I have some sketches that Bear did of the single wing, and he was explaining, when I schedule Citadel, it's because they run the single wing, and I try to schedule them close to Tennessee because they run the single wing, and I can get the team used to it beforehand. But in this particular year, Bear decided that he was going to tell Claude the first 3 plays of the game so he could make himself look good. So he said, you know, this single wing, we're going to spread it out and say, explain the play. So then the game starts, and Claude goes, you know, Citadel has this strong side offense. Don't be surprised if Bear Bryant exploits the weak side, because there's some openings in the wide flat out there. He runs Dopey Phelps off the right side, the weak side. He gains like 25 yards over to the sideline out of bounds. And the next play, he says, now, the way Citadel set up for this next play, I'd look for a crossover with Waugh Jones into the center of the field for a quick pass, because they're leaving that midfield open. Sure enough, here comes the pass to Waugh Jones. He catches it, runs it for 30 yards, and everybody's going, wow. And so then the third play comes, and he goes, now the field is open in the center. Look for another running play with Phelps more off tackle. Phelps goes up the middle for a touchdown. So the next day in the Herald Leader, the reporter's talking about the game, and he said, Bear Bryant's offense is very suspect when the radio announcer seems to know more about what's going on than the coach does. So then Claude actually started the first national coaches show. LeGru Motors was his sponsor, and he met with Bear every week, and they predicted game outcomes and all that. So when they get in there, before they went on the air, Bear said, well, Claude, I guess I messed up on that, giving you the plays. You made yourself look really good and me look really bad. But he said, you know, there's not a damn thing I can do about it now, because I can't admit what I did. So interesting stories along the way.
Oh, absolutely. And Claude did some recreation, I think, during his career, too. Recreation is the practice in the old days when a radio announcer didn't travel with a team and he would sit in the studio and do sound effects and call the game based on teletype reports and things like that that would send him back. And, of course, if you had a technical glitch of some kind, that's a challenge for the announcer.
The archives of UK will be getting copies of those if they don't already have them. There's copies of the teletypes from the Minneapolis Lakers, the pro teams. He did a lot of pro basketball reenactments. And his first game was 1945 on New Year's Day at Madison Square Garden, but he wasn't there. He was at Wave in Louisville on the teletype. And he said it would come across, somebody may not know that much about sports, they're just transcribing the game. And you got to delay it enough that you can read the transcription, determine what's really happening, and then make it exciting and meaningful to an audience, or you're going to look really bad and dull. So it was between 45 and 47 he did contract work for Kentucky games while he was in Cincinnati on WZIP. And then Ted Grizzard finally lured him down to WKLX in 1948, and one of the first games he did at KLX was the Phillips Oilers against the Fabulous Five on Stahl Field for the Olympic trials, which UK lost 56-50, and they combined both teams to make the Olympic squad and both coaching staffs. So that was a thrilling thing to be involved with. And then in 1960, he did some Olympic broadcasting on his own while in Rome on a tour he led for WVLK, and he did it on this little pre-cassette recorder, which is going to go to the archives, which is called a Mohawk Midget, which had not a cassette tape, but it had a metal sleeve reel-to-reel tape to fit in there. Do you remember this?
Over the wire?
No, it was a reel-to-reel tape.
I don't remember that.
And he had canisters, and the canisters, a lot of the broadcasts that are in the archives that you've heard, the older ones, were he would take this down to the Reds field to broadcast interviews with players. He had a shoulder strap, take it overseas. That was in Russia when he did his tapes over there during the Cold War in the 50s. So that tape recorder's been around.
Of course, Claude was the voice of the Cincinnati Reds, number two man starting in 64, right? Mm-hmm. And then 2 years with the great Wade Hoyt, the former Yankees pitcher who broadcast Reds games for many years. And then Claude took over as the number one broadcaster in 66 and continued through 67. Here's a scorecard from 1964 from Crosley Field that I went to that ball game, and up on the top it says, follow the Reds on WCKY Radio 1530, new home of the Reds ball games, with play-by-play by Wade Hoyt and Claude Sullivan. So they were happy to have him there, and that was a great chapter as well. Ralph, you mentioned the influence, of course, that he had on you personally, and Tom, just a brief word, if you would, on you wrote the foreword for the book, and you had a chance to, on assignment, I guess, pick up some tapes of Claude Sullivan, and that influenced your early work, too.
Got them from Alan, actually, the clip that played with Clarkie Mayfield is kicking the field goal at Tennessee was one of the tapes that I have that Alan gave me copies of. And the reason I sought him out to get those was because of Ralph and Jim Host telling me that, because I had grown up listening to Kaywood do play-by-play, all I'd heard of Claude was really off that album and heard about him. And they, Ralph and Jim, both told me how good Claude was and that I should listen to his tapes. And Jim told me about how meticulous Claude was in his preparation. He used the analogy of a checkerboard or a chessboard, actually, how Claude would, in his preparation, would try to see how one look here might affect something on the other side of the play or whatever, and he would try to give you that idea of what the whole chessboard looked like on the broadcast. So that emphasis on preparation was something I got from Ralph in particular, tying back to what Claude did. So, yeah, I didn't have the pleasure of listening to Claude, but I tend to think I never tried to copy anybody. I just grew up listening to the people I grew up listening to around here, didn't study the craft per se, and so I was greatly influenced by those people I listened to doing the Kentucky games and the Reds games. And so I kind of just developed my own style of doing it with some of the influence, I'm sure, of the people I listened to. So as I listen to tapes, I think I tend to get more excited than Kaywood did. And I think that probably is more how Claude was, it seems, in listening to some tapes.
Yeah.
So it's just you got to kind of do what comes naturally, I think.
And be who you are.
Yeah.
Ralph, you can help us with this era, I think. We've mentioned the names Claude and Kaywood a lot, and they were actually broadcasting at the same time. The whole setup was much different in those days with a lot of stations broadcasting, and those two kind of rose to the top in terms of the audience that they reached. But eventually, there was going to have to be a decision made, and a lot of other SEC schools had already done that. Tell us about that era where UK was moving toward that.
Well, they were not going to make the decision as long as Claude Sullivan was alive. That's written in stone. As long as Claude Sullivan was alive, they would not make the decision. As long as Kaywood Ledford was alive, they would not make the decision. Kaywood was on WHAS. They wanted the 840 clear channel, 50,000 watts, no television at that particular time, to be able to reach 34 to 40 states at night. So they wanted that coverage. They wanted Claude because Claude was the voice of the University of Kentucky inside the Commonwealth of Kentucky. There's no question about that. Now, I'm not trying in any way would I ever belittle Kaywood Ledford and his talent. What we're talking about here are two great announcers with different styles. People could make their own analogy as to whether they liked Kaywood better or whether they liked Claude, or in my case, whether you just love them both. They were both absolutely excellent broadcasters. As the story goes that when Cincinnati Reds, as I recall, didn't come down here to Lexington and say, hey, Claude, come on, old buddy, let's go up here and do the ball games. Mm-hmm. Ted Grizzard, who was a brilliant broadcaster, who some of you may remember Ted's name, you may not remember Ted's name. Ted Grizzard actually founded a show called Truth or Consequences in Chicago on WLS. He came through Lexington, Kentucky, dropped his wife off, caught a train to Los Angeles, auditioned for CBS out there, and they hired him. He was going to be what Jack Bailey became. He was going to be the voice of Truth or Consequences on radio, then it became TV. He was going to be a big deal. Well, Ted came back to get Carl Louise. She said, I'm not leaving. And he said, what do you mean you're not leaving? I got this opportunity. She says, I'm not leaving. Is that pretty close, Alan? Mm-hmm. So Ted Grizzard became the general manager of a radio station here, and eventually Garvis Kincaid hired him to run WBLK. And in between, they hired Kaywood, or Ted hired Claude Sullivan to come over there. But what they did one day, they took maybe that recorder. It could have been very easily that recorder. And they went up and they bought tickets and sat in the left field, right? Mm-hmm. In the boxes in the left field, and Claude Sullivan did a baseball game. He took the scorecard. He did the baseball game. Ted Grizzard takes it back. He knew Wade Hoyt. They knew that Wade Hoyt was going to retire. Wade Hoyt takes it to Berger, correct? Mm-hmm. They take it to Berger. They listen to it. Claude goes back and does another one, see if he was really that good. He got the job. So that's the way Claude Sullivan, as I recall.
We have the tape recordings of those two games, and when I was going through them, I thought, this is odd because he does the entire game. There's not Wade Hoyt in there or Jim McIntyre. So I looked at the dates, and I thought those were his audition tape. He actually applied a year before and was turned down because he had lack of baseball experience. They hired Gene Kelly. Wade couldn't stand him because Kelly would not go with the format of alternate innings, and he didn't like it. So Wade said, we need to get rid of this guy. And I don't know who that Irishman was, but I really liked him. And they said, that was Claude Sullivan. He goes, well, bring him back, and let's give him an audition. And that's what happened. And then the next year he was awarded the job.
But nothing is ever as easy as one might think that it is, you know, in particularly our business. Mark Story would say the same thing, I would think, as a writer for a newspaper. It's never as easy as you think it is. One time when Jimmy Carter was elected president, I remember Marilyn and I were driving to Pikeville, Kentucky, and had the story on NPR. And what they said was, a good old boy is someone who has a 1956 Oldsmobile engine block hanging from a chassis out front, but it can't belong to him. He could have wheels off of a 1947 Ford, but they can't belong to him. So they went through all of these, and they got down through it, and they said, Billy Carter is a good old boy.
Yep.
Said he doesn't have the power, but it belongs to him. Hmm. Now, think back what happened then. And that's what happens to a lot of us. We happen to be lucky. We happen to be at the right place at the right time. Me sitting in the back of a room with his dad happened to be the right thing. Me taking my tapes to his dad when I was 15 years old, and I was doing Eastern's ball games, and him listening to him, and he was doing the Cincinnati Reds, and Jim Hoste just went to work to Procter & Gamble. He said, who are we going to get to do the high school games and the regional colleges? And his dad says, well, what's the matter with Ralph? And they said, he's never done a ball game. And Claude says, I've been critiquing his tapes since he was 15 years old. Said, he can do the ball games. So that's the way I started doing it. And I have knowledge, and I could be wrong about this. Van Vance could wipe me out of this with one nod of his head. But I believe I am the only guy who ever worked on the air that's living with Claude Sullivan and Kaywood Leffert. Mm-hmm. I did high school games with Claude. I did regional college games with Claude. And the night that Claude Sullivan died, there was another guy scheduled to do Eastern versus Dayton. And the guy refused to do them. He said, I can't do them out of respect for Claude. Hmm. And the guy, general manager came to me and says, what about you? And I knew his dad, and I said, if I had died, his dad would go do the game. Am I right? Mm-hmm. That was his job.
That's right.
I went to do the game. Eastern upset Dayton that particular night, and the guy never did another basketball game. You know, in Lexington. So it's a strange road that we all have. Some people like you, some people don't. That's just the way it goes. It's like being in politics. Some people like you, some people don't. You do the best you can, you do the best of your ability, and that's the way it works.
Well, we did transition into a new era at that point, tragically, with the loss of Claude Sullivan. Then Kaywood Leffert was named as the primary announcer on the UK network as things began to consolidate.
Yeah, I kind of let that one go, didn't I? Is that what they did is that VOK was they were absolutely sure that they were going to be able to keep the primary announcer. So they go outside, and they hire a guy named Bill Sorrell. Bill Sorrell was a wonderful sports announcer. He was the voice of the Michigan State Wolverines. And they brought him down here, and he was going to be he worked a year ahead of Claude passing. He worked here maybe two, and Sorrell was really good. About the same time, Mr. Kincaid bought Channel 27. So they made Bill the sports director at Channel 27 to give him some, you know, name recognition and things of that particular nature. So then they bring build in. They were doing delays at that particular time. Channel 27 was that had gotten them away from Channel 18, where Hammond had been doing them, and they bring Bill in here to do those. Well, they just didn't read the tea leaves right. There was no way that they were going to have two originations, and there was no way that they were going to be able to have give up WHAS. It just was not going to happen. So they. A guy named Dick Frick, Richard T. Frick Company, out of New York City, came in and paid the University of Kentucky, I don't know, I'm going to say it's $30,000 for football and basketball, for everything. And everybody looked and said, boy, that's a lot of money. So, and part of the problem was Frick would make the call to get it off UK's shoulders. So they made the call. Of course, there was no call to be made. They hired Kaywood Leopard and got WHAS. They set up the network of across the stations, across the state. They didn't care about pregame shows. They didn't care about the coaches' shows. They didn't care about the postgame shows. All they wanted was when the tip-off started, they wanted on 5 minutes before, and they wanted off the air 5 minutes afterwards. That's all. And open up the windows for the rest of us coming in there and doing that stuff. So that's the way that came about. It was really preordained, but it was preordained to the point as long as Claude Sullivan was living, or as long as Kaywood Leopard were living, there would not be a change made. I'll never forget, Alan, I think maybe I told you this when we're talking about your book. I'm so lucky to have been around Coach Rupp and Coach Bryant. I start telling these stories and people say, you're lying. Well, I was there, so I guess I wasn't lying. Is one night, you know, Coach Rupp would come up sometimes at practice and just sit down with me and just start telling me things. And one day he looked at me somewhere, and I'm not sure it was, and he says, Ralph, this is awful to say, but I've been thinking, if Claude would have lived, we probably wouldn't have filled Memorial Coliseum. That's how good he was. Now, folks, that's a high praise. That's a high praise.
Absolutely. Well, of course, you and Kaywood made a great team for two decades, and I'm sure many in here remember listening to you and Kaywood working together. Let me just shift over and ask Tom. You listened to Kaywood, and that means, of course, you're listening to Ralph as well, and you heard them working together, and later on, of course, even in your professional career, they were still working together. What in your mind, and I'll ask Dick the same question too, but what in your mind made them such a great team?
It's great chemistry. I think I'm sure this you could certainly feel it as a listener, but and I know it was true. Just the great respect that Ralph had for Kaywood, and so he wasn't trying to outdo Kaywood. He was his partner, and doing everything, both of them, very much to make the broadcast sound as good as it could sound. And they had just a tremendous relationship, working with each other, great respect for each other. And so I think that was what made it work so well.
Mm-hmm. And let me add something to that, if I might. Perhaps two things. Is it later in Kaywood's career, say the last 5 or 6 years, we had tremendous amount of TV games. Nearly all of them were going to TV at that particular time. And UK would bring a monitor out there, and they would set up for us, or it wouldn't be UK, it'd be the television network, and we'd turn it off and most of the time. And when Kaywood would come in to me before a ball game, and this is the kind of relationship we had. We trusted one another because he knew I didn't want his job, and he, Dad Burns, sure didn't want mine. And he'd turn to me, and he'd say, and Dick has heard him say this, he'd say, if I get to doing TV, you tell me. Mm-hmm. So he'd be sitting there, and you'd hear him, instead of going through all the things that he's going through, describing this shot, describing this move, which as Kaywood could, you know, eloquently do, he might say, comes down the floor, puts up an 18-footer, good. And if he did that twice, I'd lean over to him and say, just tap him. Say, TV. That's all I'd do. Say, TV. Boy, all of a sudden, that switch, that TV switch would go off, and he would start back into the Kaywood Leopard that we all knew and loved. And he never shut up. But if he got into it again, just tap him. Just tap him and say, TV. Yeah. Because in all reality, I think he hated TV. I got to tell one Kaywood Leopard story.
Sure.
I got time. Yeah, bro.
Tell as many as you like.
They brought up the Duke game played up there in the Hall of Fame. And Eddie Sutton was the coach. And Eddie had gotten, you know, reporting difficulty recruiting, et cetera, et cetera. And somebody got to Dick Vitale and said to Dick Vitale, Eddie Sutton needs to be fired. Well, Eddie, you know, so far they proved nothing on him whatsoever. And to my knowledge, have still not proved nothing on him, despite the fact that they have awards showing that they did. But they ended up having Dick Vitale getting on doing that. So Kaywood comes back, goes to Channel 27, you know, goes in, puts on his coat and tie, sits down there, and he does his commentary. Some of you may remember Kaywood's comments. Mm-hmm. This was his commentary. Kaywood Leopard's commentary. Dick Vitale is an idiot. And he goes on to explain it. Well, Jerry Tipton writes a story about how bad that they're going to treat Dick Vitale when he comes in for this weekend's game, and that there's a chance that somebody would assassinate him. True story, Mark. So we're sitting down there on the front row as he and I would get there, sometimes three and a half hours before the game. We'd have all of our stuff done. We'd be sitting there drinking coffee, and he'd be smoking cigarettes. And Dick Vitale comes in. As soon as he sees Kaywood across the hall, he says, Kaywood Leffler, you said I was an idiot. You said I was an idiot. And he comes right over in front of Kaywood. He said, Kaywood Leffler, you said I was an idiot. You said I was an idiot. And Kaywood says, you are an idiot, Dick. He starts it again, and Kaywood says, move a little, Dick. That guy in the upper balcony may be a bad shot. Yeah, and that's what I had to put up with.
Well, obviously, you enjoyed each other's company all those years.
Oh,
that's for sure.
I tell you what, if it was somebody over here, Dick worked with us on the radio broadcast at the games more than Tom did. Tom was in the studio a lot of time. Is that Dick would see this happen, so there'd be a TV guy sitting here. Kay would never, ever say anything to anybody to offend him, right? Right. Well, make that damn guy move. I got into more fights with TV people,
yeah.
Even to the point one day of taking this guy's camera and taking it off and putting it on the table. You know, that sort of thing. Kay would go, just like that.
And that's why, that's one of the reasons that you see TV video guys in the end zones, because there's two things. Number one, they're in Kaywood's way.
Yeah.
Now, officials were afraid they'd trip over him. And there were guys who, for whatever reason, instead of sitting on their butt, they'd get up on their knees right in front of these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Kaywood would get them down. You know, slap that guy down. It's a wonder I hadn't gotten shot by television.
Dick, we mentioned the award-winning documentary when Kaywood retired, so you got some different perspectives on his career, and we were talking a little bit about the great team that he and Ralph made, but what did you take away from that documentary?
And to follow up on Tom's answer, it basically was the mutual respect. They loved each other, and you know, but as Ralph said, he knew I didn't want his job and vice versa, but they respected the job that each of them did. Ralph was a play-by-play guy, capable play-by-play guy, so he could appreciate a great play-by-play guy. And mention how you get spoiled when you're working for networks that take care of everything. Ralph took care of Kaywood. Kaywood only had to worry about doing the games. That's all he had to worry about, and so he poured all his energy into that, and I knew for a fact that he appreciated that. So you had that going. Now, when I started doing interviews for this documentary, and by the way, you mentioned my free hour. I came from Minette Bay. I'm working on another documentary. So anyway, I'm going to plug that at the end if you don't mind. But they just worked together so well that, you know, whenever I would go to do these interviews, it was almost like I was interviewing the same person. What made Kaywood so special, so great? And the first thing out of everybody's mouth was preparation. You know, I mean, we hear this about Claude Sullivan. I heard that over and over and over again about Kaywood Leffler. You know, and a lot of it was some of the history. Kaywood was an English teacher. I mean, you worry about or you wonder about his command of the language. If he had not gone into broadcasting, he would have ended up teaching English somewhere. And I'm sure.
And was teaching English at Harlan County.
That's right, mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
at
you know, that kind of fills in the blanks there a little bit. But the thing that always tickled me a little bit, puzzled me, but just kind of tickled me, was their respect for each other was so genuine. I never heard a cross word, never. The respect was so genuine, people would come up to me and say, come on, they really can't stand each other. I mean, they can't be. I'm like, no. Ralph doted on Kaywood, especially he did toward the end. Ralph doted on Kaywood, and I know Kaywood appreciated that. Now, as a young guy, I will never forget this. I'm in Rupp Arena. I had just started working for Ralph, and I guess it had to have been about a year because it was when we got into Rupp. No, we were already in Rupp Arena. That's right. And Ralph says, hey, would you go get Kaywood a cup of coffee? And I was kind of like, I'm no coffee boy, you know. But then Ralph said, oh, we all do it. I'm like, well, of course we do. So I ran off and got his coffee. But and one of the first football road trips we made was to – that I made when I was with the network was – to the Meadowlands, Rutgers, and Tom Devine was driving, and I came out, and a couple guys were in the car, and the front seat was open, and I'm like, oh, lucky me, score. And I sit down, and Ralph and Tom go like this. And I'm like, oh. That's Haywood's seat. So I jumped out and never made that mistake again. But, no, it was great. When you grow up listening to Haywood like I did, and I actually interned for Haywood for a couple months over one Christmas. So now I've gone from, you know, the $9 transistor radio with the little earpiece while I'm delivering papers to working for and with Ralph and Haywood. I mean, again, you talk about lucky. I will say this, though. That I remember I told you I filled in on the when Haywood was gone. Well, Haywood went off to accept an award, so he missed a basketball game. Ralph slid over a chair. Rick Shaw slid over a chair and did color, and they sat me down to do the scoreboard. And Ralph's right. I used to do the scoreboard at the games. I feel bad for Darren and Keith and all these guys because they have them back in the studio just in case the line goes down. And that's happened before, so they've been our lifelines. But they had me... And they were able to engineer it so I could record things and make phone calls and stuff sitting right next to them. Well, the very first game I did, let me back up, the first game I ever covered at the Coliseum for the Colonel, Sam Newton brought one of those great Alabama teams in there and kicked the stuffings out of UK the year they went 13-13 under Joe. And I think it's still the worst loss ever at Memorial Coliseum. That was my first varsity story, right?
Yeah. That was so the year now, I got to do the games for WBKY.
Fantastic, yeah. I think I followed you there. Yeah. So anyhow, they had me doing the scoreboard. Who's playing? Sam Newton in Alabama. Worst loss in the history of Rupp Arena. So I'm the albatross. But no, they were so professional and so kind. But what was the best thing of all was the respect that other people, coaches and broadcasters, showed Ralph and Haywood. They would always come over and say hello, shake their hands, and it was very impressive and impressionable to me. And I remember hearing and reading guys like Dick Enberg and Bob Costas, and you can go down the list of guys who, as young announcers, grew up listening to them on 840 and how much it affected their careers, and that brought it home.
I want to tell one, my hat here. Talking about Haywood and I, we did everything together. Marilyn and Frances were like sisters. They did everything together. They moved within a half mile of where we lived, and they came to Lexington. Haywood would turn to me at a football game because they would tailgate. He'd say, "See if the girls are there yet." I'd go, "No, they don't know there are two kickoffs in the game." But we were in Athens, Georgia. And he looked at me, and this is back in the 70s. I thought I had plenty of hair then. He looked at me and said, "You're going bald." said, "You need a hat." So we went into this place called Dick Ferguson's. He bought me the hat.
Wow.
He picked it out, said, "Here you are." So, you know, I wear it a lot, Donahan. Yeah. Is where Haywood left for a hat. And later on, he bought me another one, you know, a brown one. He says, "You can't just have a gray one. You could have a brown one." So that's how close we were. Is that when our daughter was born, he was the first guy at the hospital, you know, that sort of thing. And well, when he was in the hospital, I don't think I missed a day I was in town being there.
Haywood, in his farewell, of course, graciously acknowledged that you would be in that chair and, of course, by, in a way, throwing his support behind you as you started in the play-by-play era after Haywood retired at the end of the 1992 season. So he had to make that transition a little easier for you.
I was not going to do it. And he took me to the coach house. He said, "No, you don't have any choice." He said, "You're going to do it." And that's, I said, okay. Then that's how it worked.
You know, Haywood did the games for 39 years and did two national championship basketball teams. And then you were a basketball play-by-play man for 8 years and also did two national championships.
Actually, I was for nine. You give Tom credit for one more and take one away from me, but that's okay. I probably didn't get paid for it anyway.
But you did have two championship teams in 96 and 98.
Did have championship teams. Well, I think that's a better coach than he was.
Yeah.
There was nobody a better coach than Haywood. Now, everybody asked me about that final game and Coach Krzyzewski said that was set up, wasn't it? The answer to that is no. Is that we were sitting there and Haywood is doing that beautiful closing that you read there a few minutes ago, or heard a while ago. And here comes Mike Krzyzewski across the floor. And he's about this far away from me, and he says, "Ralph, I need your headphones." So I take my headphones off, and I hand them to Mike. And I knew Mike back then. I knew Mike Krzyzewski really well. I'd done a lot of the NCAA games on TV, so I knew him. I knew him actually as an assistant coach at Army. So I handed them to him. I didn't know he was coming over. And that's when I went back to get Patino, while he had my headphones. I went back there to get Rick during that period of time. But that's when – that's class. Now, one more Mike Krzyzewski story. We are in Philadelphia. So last year I did the games. I thought it was 2002. And we lose to USC. And so they wouldn't allow me to go in to watch Kentucky practice. So I'm sitting on the bus, and Duke pulls up. And I figured, well, I'm just going to get off the bus and speak to Mike. So I jumped off the bus. And as Tom said, we had a lot of different relationship with the coaches, the other coaches and people have now. So I get off, and there's Mike, ramrod straight, standing there. I walk up, and he said, "Ralph, how's Kay Wood doing?" And I said, he's doing wonderful. He said, "How did he make it this year without doing the games?" I said, "I talked to him a lot. He seems to be doing well. How's Francis?" So he goes through all that. And he said, "What do you all think about Rick going to Louisville?" He just made that announcement that day. And I said, "I don't think it's settled in on the people of Kentucky yet, but I don't think they like it. I would never, ever do anything like that. I would never go to North Carolina or North Carolina State or anyone that was an opponent of Duke. That's classless." With that, he hugged me and he walked off.
Wow.
Now, that's a pretty strong statement. Pretty strong statement. The thing, I've never forgotten that. And I went back, and Bowie said, what were you and Coach K talking about?
Could I tell Coach K story real quickly? I'm amazed that you were even able to get close to him, because if he were to walk in now, he'd have four people with him, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He'd have two assistants, a body man, an operation, whatever. He's Coach K. I get it. But when I worked for Ralph, we were an ABC radio station, and they would call me from New York, sports people, and say, "Hey, can you send me some Kentucky interviews, some sound bites?" And they'd pay me a little bit. And then there was nobody in Louisville who would do that for U of L, believe it or not. U of L was going to Final Fours every other year. So they'd say, "Are you going to the Ohio State-Louisville game?" I'm like, "Well, I can, because both my brothers went to school there," so I'd drive down. So they were playing Duke, and Duke was not very good, but they had a kid from Lexington named Vince Taylor. Remember Vince? Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Tate's Creek, that's right. And I think they were 10-17 or something that year. And they, people wanted to fire Krzyzewski. So I thought, well, I'll go get some comments from Denny Crum, ship them to New York, get my money. But I'll interview Vince Taylor, the kid from Lexington, and I'll get a comment from Mike Krzyzewski. So I do all that, and then I go to the last thing is to Krzyzewski, because he's talking to media, introduce myself and said, blah, 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 Vince Taylor. "Oh, of course." And so he says, "Why don't we go over here and get out of the hallway?" And we walked under you remember the old Freedom Hall had the bleachers on the end zone? We're standing under the bleachers, empty popcorn boxes and half cups of beer on the ground, and I'm interviewing one-on-one Mike Krzyzewski. Gave me everything I needed, very cordial, very nice. "Thank you very much, Coach," and walked off. You flash forward about 12 years and with the NCAA Network, and I had Duke in several of my regionals, and there he goes walking down the hall with that train of people behind him, like the Secret Service, and I just started laughing. And somebody looked at me, and I told him, I could no more walk up to him now. They'd throw me to the floor, But that's success. But I'm impressed you were able to get him.
We always had that relationship. The first time I met him was in the Phoenix Hotel when he was assistant coach for Bobby Knight. But the first time I met him.
Well, he didn't know me, but he sure
did. And the other guy that I grew to have absolutely zero respect for, thought he may be in the world's coach, worst coach I've ever seen, was Digger Phelps. Mm. He was an ass with a capital A.
And he hated UK.
Right. And one time I went down to do an interview with him sitting down there in the end zone, and I forgot who his assistants were then, and he got real smart. And I looked at him and I said, "Coach, you need us a hell of a lot more than we need you." And I walked off. Well, later on he's coaching against Coach Rupp. He comes, the game's being held up. The game is being held up. So Coach Rupp gets up and saunters down there, and he says, "What seems to be the problem?" And we sit right at the middle of the floor then. And the official says, "Well, Coach Phelps doesn't want to play with this game, this ball, because it's got your name on it." And Coach Rupp says, "Well, find one with his name, and we'll play with it."
I believe it. But Tom, it wasn't too long after Ralph took over in basketball that the change was made in football after you did five seasons, right, Ralph, in football? Is that correct?
All I know is I bought five radio stations and I had to go to work.
Yeah. But, Tom, at that time, as I recall now, your audition tape for what landed you the football play-by-play job was from a high school game. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that one.
Well, the main thing that landed me the job was him being in my corner.
Yeah, right.
So it was, nothing was on the tape. It was just that the tape didn't screw it up. it was I'd done some college games because of working at VLK. We did the SEC tournament when it was played in Lexington. Ralph worked it out where we were able to be a local origination of the games because Kentucky fans would want to listen to them. And with the OVC tournament was in Lexington one year, and I did OVC. So I'd done a little bit of college basketball, but my football work was all high school. We actually did a game in 95 on a Saturday afternoon when Sean Alexander was at Boone County and they were going to come in and play Henry Clay. And it was a big game, so they moved it to Saturday afternoon. The Wildcats weren't playing. Mm-hmm. And so I forget I remember Bill Ransdell was our sideline guy. I can't remember who did the game with me up in the booth. But anyway, we did a broadcast of that game, and I think that was actually the tape I used because we had a sideline guy and really orchestrated broadcast. That was what the tape that I used. But Ralph had called me in about a year before he decided to step down and say he was going to, and he would lobby for me. And so that was the best asset that I had as far as getting the job. And then, fortunately, Steve Newton gave me the greatest piece of advice when he took me to lunch about a month before the first game in 97. He said, "You've got this great opportunity. You've worked hard to put yourself in this position. I just got one piece of advice for you. Don't screw it up." So the only two times I was ever nervous doing a game, once was the national championship game in basketball, because you want to those are going to live on whether they're good or not if the team you're following wins, and Kentucky did. So then I thought they would, so I thought it would be around, so I wanted to do a good job on the championship game. And then the other time was the first game that in 97, because I knew if with Kentucky fans and the standard that had been set, if it wasn't good, there might not be a second game, much less a second year. So that was the only other time I was nervous.
I was going to ask you about that because you grew up near here, and obviously all of you on this panel had a good feel for what the Kentucky fans' passion was for a good broadcast as they followed their team. Was that on your mind as you got started, or were you able to kind of put that aside and just focus on the work?
Very much so. I've got a picture where Ralph and Kaywood came in the booth, one of my favorite pictures. I got the most to sign it. So it's up in my office where they came in the booth to wish me well. But, you know that – and that's part of what has always, I think, made the broadcasts as good as they are, the standard that was set back to, you know, when Claude and Kaywood were doing them and several other people was that – Kentucky fans expect it to be the best. Mm-hmm. And then when it became one network, that was always the commitment. And so we still try to, you know, Gable speak to that now, doing games. That's what you shoot for, is to do it as good as you can, as well as you can, because that's what Kentucky fans expect. And so that's, you know, whether it's the play-by-play or the anything else or just the technical aspects of it. And Kentucky always did kind of innovative things and adding things like coaches' shows and pregame and postgame and call-in shows. And Kentucky usually was the trendsetter in all of those things. It's a funny story on postgame show. This comes from Mike Pratt, my basketball partner. When he was playing, they were obviously still playing a Memorial Coliseum at the time, and there was a back door to the Coliseum, a staircase that led up to the back parking lot, which isn't there now, was taken up for the Joe Kraft Center. Well, there's a parking lot, but anyway, part of the main parking lot next to the Coliseum is now the Joe Kraft Center. But that back staircase led up to that parking lot. And Mike Casey from Shelbyville, Mike Pratt's best friend, Mike Pratt from Dayton, they alternated each home game letting their buddies in for free from that back parking lot down that staircase. So in one game, Casey's buddies from Shelby County were going to get in free, and Pratt was down at the bottom of the steps as the lookout. The next game it switched. Casey would be the lookout. Pratt would let his buddies from Dayton in for free. And Pratt was the lookout this one night. And Coach Rupp broke out of his normal routine and came by at a different time. And Mike Pratt knows Casey's up there, so he starts coughing, and that's the signal. Coach Rupp was there. Mike, what are you doing here? Well, Coach, Casey, he's trying to think of something. Casey is sick as a dog, and he's up there throwing up, Coach. And, well, make sure he gets looked at, Mike. And, oh, I will, Coach. And Casey was perfectly fine. Goes out and gets like 35 points against whoever they were playing. So Coach Rupp goes on the postgame show with Kaywood. Kaywood, that boy was sick as a dog, and he played the game of his life.
You mentioned Mike Pratt, but you have had some really good partners to work with there in the booth, and Pecoraro and Pratt are, I think, as a listener, just outstanding, and you have a good mix with them too. But we've been fortunate as listeners to have some great teams on there. Yeah, as
Jeff
well.
Van Note before Jeff Pecoraro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fortunately, Jeff Pecoraro was named Jeff, or he wouldn't have gotten the job.
That's right. That's required. Yeah. Dick, I was going to ask you to, if you could, just kind of give us a summary of how television became a big part of things. You know, WKYT was the primary sports partner for UK for many years. But in the 80s, things began to grow, and you've been involved on production of coaches' shows. You've been on the broadcasts. Tell us about the growth of television and how that moved in on things.
Well, it's funny because local TV growth now is shrinking, believe it or not, because of the SEC network. So we're the official UK TV station. We keep asking ourselves, well, what does that mean? You know, so we try to make our own way on that. But anyhow, yeah, I mean, we were doing, and this is what kind of curbed our enthusiasm, if you will, on this. We would do specials. We would do pregame shows for the network. We would send them statewide. There was always something, and that's how I learned as much about production as I did about being in front of the cameras. And I enjoyed equally, you know, making it happen, as you know, in addition to being on the other side of the camera. In fact, there's times I'm more comfortable writing and editing, and you know, let the other guys, you know, stand in front of the guys, pretty boys like Keith. Yeah. So, but anyhow, you know, we did NCAA tournament specials, football bowl game specials, but pretty soon the network, specifically CBS, but all the networks started doing this, they really started putting the screws to us locally. They used to pay us to carry their programming. Eventually, that flip-flopped. Now we have to pay CBS. And preemption hours have shrunken. They used to give us a big block of time and say, okay, you're allowed to preempt this much of our programming, but no more than that. Well, pretty soon it was like this and like this and like this, and it's getting smaller and smaller to where our program director would have to keep track literally to the half hour, to the 15-minute block. And we'd go to him or her and say, hey, you know, why don't we do a pregame show for this NCAA game where, you know, Kentucky's playing Florida? We're out of time. We can't. We have nowhere to put it. So you don't see nearly as much now as you used to. I've been fortunate in that we've turned some documentaries that actually Cameron Mills was our executive producer, but he EP'd both the specials we did on the 96 and 98 championship teams. Fortunately, there's not a lot of network programming on Christmas Day. So those were two of the time slots, and they've reserved the one for the one I'm working on now. And that's actually a pretty good time slot on Christmas. You're talking about late in the afternoon. People have done the gifts and the dinner, and you know, you're on the couch like, oh, my goodness. And, you know, and you've either got the NBA on or a football game or, we hope, one of our documentaries. So, but that has changed now, like I said, because of the SEC network. We no longer originate games. We used to do a lot of delayed games and then some delayed games, then a few delayed games, and then one or two, and then we have maybe the blue-white game, and that's it. And now they're all on the SEC network. So now, fortunately, some of us have transitioned to that locally on what is SEC Plus, basically, which is what you see on your computer. That's where I do baseball on TV. I do volleyball, occasionally softball, and I've done a couple soccer matches. Dave Baker does some stuff as well. So that keeps us involved on the TV side. I'm fortunate in that Darren Hedrick, who is the radio voice of the UK women, and the baseball team, has a magnificent bald head right back there. He is the voice of the baseball Cats and the women's basketball team. When he's not doing baseball, when he's tied up with women's basketball, I fill in for him on the radio doing baseball, which is a real treat. And then I transition over to the next booth over, and I work with Doug Flynn. You talk about great partners. Doug is just tremendous. And I remember I've done – Doug and I did two summers of minor league baseball for CBS Sports. And we've just known each other and done games for so long. You talk about chemistry. We would have crews from all over the country wherever we worked, and they would always say the same thing. How long have you guys done these games? And we look at each other and go, we don't know. That's how long we've done these games together. But it is such a joy when you're working with somebody that you truly like and respect and care about. And Doug is so good. And after the very first game, I turned to him and I said, you got to get a tape to the Reds. You really do. Well, not just because of me, but now he's working with the Reds. Jenny Dalton Hill worked with me on softball broadcast. I told somebody she'll be at ESPN. Hey, Jack Givens worked with me on the Transylvania. When I was working for Ralph, we did Transylvania basketball on the radio, and it ended up being simulcast on telecable. Remember the old telecable? Well, Jack Givens was my radio partner. Next thing you know, he's 19 years on the Orlando Magic Network. So the secret here is work with me. And you'll leave me behind. But, there's two or three others, and I will tell you this as well. I just flashed on this. When I was at BKY, of course, Ralph and Kay would have the coach, whoever the coach was. I guess it was Kersey at the time. Well, our post-game interviews were whatever coach we could grab out of the booth next door. Assistant coaches before they get the elevator. See that guy in the blue shirt right there? That's Rick Fromm. He was a GA, and half the time one year he was our post game radio guy. Remember that?
Long time ago.
I know we're running toward the end of the program. I want to make you a prediction that these two guys heard me say 25 years ago. And every day, every season, we're closer to it. It will not be very long until Rupp Arena is nothing more than a sound stage.
That's right.
That's all it will be. They've already cut down some of the seats in the thing. They keep raising ticket prices. People didn't go to the Evansville game. They probably won't go to the Lamar game, in any great numbers. People are going to quit going to the game because they're all on television. It'll be nothing more than a sound stage. Write that down. But 25 years ago when I said that, everybody looked at me and said, including the host, and said, you're crazy. Ask them today.
Mm-hmm. Ralph, before we do wrap things up, let me just ask you all, Alan, we'll start with you, just a very brief comment on what it's meant to you to be associated with these sports programs, both you and me, if you can feel like speaking for your father, what he would say to a question like that.
Yeah, it's a whole lifetime of memories, and one of the things that I think I learned from all this was that what really pushed my father was, I think, the love of sports and painting the pictures for people. One of the things I was thinking of as you all were talking, that he was injured in high school basketball. He was captain of the Winchester High basketball and football teams, and he got injured in his sophomore year. Almost lost his leg from osteomyelitis. And that's what kicked him into broadcasting, was somebody said when a year after he had been sick, he came to the games and he started announcing on the PA system. Somebody suggested he try. Next thing you know, he's in Ashland, Kentucky at WCMI as a 17-year-old and is doing newscasts. So what he always kept in his mind, he really was thankful for the opportunities that high school sports gave him, but that he was able to carry that on with broadcasting. So he did every Kentucky high school state tournament, Ralph knows this, from 1947 to 1967 until he passed away. The last year he was limited in what he could do. And I've got the programs to prove it with all the brackets filled out. He gave back to the Kentucky high school athletics because of what he got out of high school sports. And he never forgot that. And I was looking at notes. I'm putting together final materials for the archives. And I noted that he had his handwritten notes said 67 when he was the last year he was alive. He did 30 high school basketball games. 30. And he did 5 Eastern college games. He did 3 Transylvania games, and he did a Kentucky Wesleyan game. Tom, I don't think they'd let you do that this year if you had time to. But he always found time to do the games. And Sam Newton told me when I interviewed him, he said, I'd look up and there'd be Claude Sullivan doing my game. I went, what in the hell is he doing here? Is he not busy? Does he not have anything to do? And in 52, when Kentucky had the death penalty, Kaywood hadn't started yet, but Claude, they had two blue-white games that filled Memorial Coliseum, and Claude broadcast both of those. And that year he did Eastern's entire season. I don't even know if he got paid to do it. I assume he did. But there was a joke, a letter that the manager of VLK sent him, Don Horton, that said, since Kentucky's not playing basketball this year, your pay's being cut accordingly. And here, and I saw the letter, and I showed it to my mom, and she started laughing. She goes, it was a joke. That was Don Horton playing a joke. There's no postage stamp on the envelope, and the signature's in pencil. But he kept giving back, I think, to the sport and the high school athletes. So he got inducted into the High School Hall of Fame this 2 years ago, which was, to me, it probably would have been his best award of the four Hall of Fames he received. And one final note about, I think, the I had a couple things here. Oh, quick story about Adolph. In 1950, Kentucky had the worst defeat they ever had in Madison Square Garden. City College in New York beat them 39 points. And there was an article that I found when I was doing the book, and it said Claude Sullivan stayed up all night with Adolph, consoling him in his hotel room, and they probably had a few drinks as Adolph paced the room going, 39 damn points. 39 damn points. And so that's how close they were. They got close enough to be in the hotel room after your worst loss you've ever had in your career.
That is pretty close. And as you pointed out earlier, of course, Claude was 21 when he started. So you're 21 years old and you're trying to work with Bear Bryant and Adolph Ruff. That sounds pretty challenging.
Yeah, that was intimidating.
That sounds pretty challenging.
Another thing is that in that period of time when he started, he couldn't get a national broadcaster's job at 22 because they weren't hiring because of the soldiers' jobs were being held. So when he finally got back and started at Kentucky, he became such good friends with the Fabulous Five. Wah Jones was one of his best friends. They were the same age. And in one case, Alex Groza, I think, was 2 years older than Claude because he came back from the war and then finished college.
Yeah.
So it was a unique time, and it allowed him to have a unique relationship with the players as friends that he became very close with.
Ralph, what about you? What would you say means the most to you now as you look back on your association with UK Sports?
I wouldn't have anything I have. I've done many of the things that I've done. I've met presidents of the United States. I've traveled many countries, nearly every state in America. I knew Coach Bryant, knew Coach Rupp, knew all the other coaches and well. I've been very fortunate, very fortunate. And what I tried to do whenever it's in his book, try to do what Claude Sullivan taught me. I said it earlier. I tried to build a wheel by using the spokes of doing a lot of different things. And in doing so, I think, and Alan, I think, would agree with this, Alan Stein, who built the baseball team here, the Legends, I think that in doing that we built probably the most solid broadcasting company that there has ever been in Central Kentucky. We had the number two ranked FM country station in America. It was the number one profit radio station in America. And what I always hated about it had beaten our AM by one. And so I think that I would never have been able to have walked through the doors that I walked through to have met governors, to have met senators, to have met the important business people. When I walked into a banker's office and asked him for a loan, I didn't have to sell myself. They knew who I was. They had been listening to me for years. So I always tried to play upon that particular point of the fact, yes, that's who I am. Thank you very much. Now let's talk business. You know, and if they want to talk sports, we would talk sports. So that was the part that I think I brought to the table. I think one of my strong suits in life was being able to pick out talent. There's such one right here. There's such one right here. There's such one right there. And it wasn't that I picked it out. It's somebody each time called me and said, hey, here's some good people maybe you need to talk to. And there are dozens of others like that. I was able to give opportunity to many people. I mean, look at Dave Baker. Dave Baker has still been on television. Nobody ever heard him on radio. We hadn't brought him in there to fill in for Gabe. And there are a bunch more people in that particular range. So I don't want to play up anything that I did. I was not much. But what I think I was smart enough to realize that these guys had talent, and I would teach them what I knew, and I'd just get the hell out of the way.
Well, Tom, you've got a few years to look ahead, too, in addition to looking back. But how would you answer that question?
For me, it was very – I didn't realize how much of a lottery ticket I was trying to look for, I think, when I was a young kid. And I remember we had a sales manager that had worked for VLK that came to our station in Paris where I had started in 77 when I was 16, a guy named Jerry Foley that had worked for Ralph. And Jerry got me an interview with Ralph when I was starting my freshman year at UK at the old Phoenix Hotel. And I remember riding the elevator up to the sixth floor and going in and talking to Ralph. And, of course, I knew he was going to hire me and recognize the greatness that was there and hire me that day. It didn't happen for a few years later. And it's funny, I had a tape of one of the first times I was on the air, actually, when I was young, and when I was working at VLK for Ralph. And our program director was a lady named Susan Piston. And I gave her the tape and said, this was a young kid that wanted to be a broadcaster. Do you think he had any hope that we should give him a shot for like a weekend job or something? She tossed it on my desk the next day and said, no hope.
Let me jump in. One time, Tom had been with us for a while, and we had this guy, and I'll not use any name. Y'all can figure out who he was, but he was a curly-haired sports announcer here in town. And he came in my office one day very brash and like that and demanded, you're going to hire me. You're going to hire me to do sports. I said, what makes you think I'm going to hire you? He said, you're going to hire me to do sports. I said, okay. Are you better than Dick Gabriel? Are you better than Dave Baker? Are you better than Tim Smile? Are you better than Tom Leach? He turned and walked out of my office.
Well, it was I was very fortunate to get hired to work and be a part of that team and then get on the UK team and have really enjoyed just the sense of team that we've always had and trying to do something to meet a high standard. And so we really do take a lot of pride in doing that. And so it's fun. And from, you know, working that way, it's when you are in an operation where it's not that way, it stands out pretty quickly and it's not a whole lot of fun. So we have really always the favorite pictures I have in my office are pictures of, you know, our broadcast crew at different spots, or our best stories are always, and we still, you know, get together. I was our producer for many years, had lunch with yesterday. We got together last year at Christmas at Ramsey's, and it was Ralph, and he brought Kyle Macy, and he brought John Short too, and Mike Dodson. And Tom Devine, who was a longtime engineer, and I think Gabe may have been there. And finally, I looked up at the end of the day and I said, well, we've got Ralph and Kyle to do the games. I could do the pregame. Devine engineers, Dodson produces, and we've got a caller. We can do a broadcast. So it's just been, you know, it's. I always thought it would be tremendous fun, and it's been even more than I expected. So it's been great to work with all these guys.
Well, we're lucky and we know it, and I've told you how lucky I am. And, again, if I could back up, when I'd interviewed for the job, I was also looking at newspapers, and I had a standing request from the Associated Press bureau chief in Louisville to come interview after I graduated UK. I'd been the managing editor of the paper, and I had interviewed, and they offered me a part-time job. And my mother said, you've worked too hard. In college, I was on a five-year plan, academic red shirt, and she said, you need a full-time job. I said, yeah. So I was going downtown. I was walking out the door, resume in hand, just to drop it off at the AP, and the phone rings. And I looked back, and I thought, yeah, you know, might be for Mom. Pick it up. It's WVLK. They made it a full-time job. Had I gone out that door, somebody else might be sitting here right now. So when I started, this is how glamorous the job was, all right? Phoenix Hotel, top floor. Building had been condemned, all right? I poked around once on one of the floors, and I'm like, man, I don't want to be on one of these floors if the building collapses. So anyway, you take the elevator up to the top floor. But when I'd get there in the morning, I worked a split shift, okay? 6 a.m., 10 a.m., come back in the afternoons, making $120 a week, having a time of my life. But when I'd get there, here's what my instructions were. You have to go to the boiler room door and pound on it to wake up the night watchman so he'll let you in the door. That's the only door of the building that they could open at that hour. So I'd have to go in there and, you know, make sure that he'd wake up and get on the elevator and go up and do my job. And I remember thinking, boy, I don't think Vin Scully started this way. But if you sat me down and said, all right, you're going to be in broadcasting, not in newspapers, what would you like to do? Well, I'd love to do some play-by-play. Check. I wouldn't mind being on the UK network at some point in some way. Check. Sports talk radio hadn't even started yet. Once that started, I thought, that might be fun. And then next thing you know, because of my relationship with Jim Host, I'm a reporter and then a producer with the NCAA Radio Network for 11 years. I produced the SEC football championship game on radio for 15 years and the basketball radio broadcast for 15 years. And then because of my relationship with then IMG, the guy in charge of IMG, which was the rights holder for UK, put together the minor league baseball package for CBS, and it was he had done it so haphazardly, he called me one day, you want to do minor league baseball? Okay, you know, send a tape to New York. I'm like, okay. Next thing you know, Doug Flynn and I are flying all over the country. Lucky. But, you know, the line about luck being where hard work, preparation, you know, you had to be ready for that. And that's one of the things I've always appreciated about Ralph, really, the two Ralphs and Jim Host. They always pushed you to be the best you could be. Is it as good as it can be? Don't settle. Is it as good as it can be? And some of that's gone now with some of these broadcasts and some of these companies that own the rights and things like that.
That's our look at the history of UK sports broadcasting. I think our panel enjoyed the discussion. I think the audience did too, and hope you did too in listening to this segment of the WUKY Sports Page podcast. Special thanks today to our panelists, Ralph Hacker, Tom Leach, Dick Gabriel, and Alan Sullivan, and also a special thanks to Heath Elsenson of Hughes Reporting and Video Service for essential technical assistance. Next time on the WUKY Sports Page podcast, we'll hear from Oliver Barnett, an outstanding defensive end who earned third-team All-America honors while playing for Coach Jerry Claiborne at the University of Kentucky in the late 1980s. He has been selected as Kentucky's legend for the SEC Championship weekend. He'll represent UK at the events surrounding the SEC Championship game in Atlanta, December 7th.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.